5 years ago, if somebody would have told me that I can copy and paste my designs from Figma to a live website, I think I probably would have lost it. But that's exactly what it's like building websites in Framer today. All you need is the Figma to Framer plugin. Just select the layers you want to copy, run the plugin, paste into Framer, and then you are ready to publish it directly to the internet. It feels a little bit like magic, and you can experience it today. All you have to do is head to dive.club/framer to get started. Okay, now on to the episode.
The term prompt engineering gets thrown around a lot. I kind of think prompt design is more of an interesting term. Like, I'm designing this kitchen, and the model is the chef, and I have to put the right things in the kitchen in the right place so that the model can make whatever the customer orders, because we don't know what they're going to order. It's experience design, no different than thinking through, why did this person fall off this onboarding flow?
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. This week's episode is with George Kettenberg, who's a product design lead at Humane. So this week's episode is all about designing AI products and how the role of product designer evolves in an AI native company. One of my favorite parts is hearing how George prototypes his ideas now that he's working directly with these language models. But before we get into the weeds of all of that, let's learn a little bit more about George's 8 years at Meta and why he decided to make such a big change.
Meta was my first like product design role. And so I kind of view it as graduate school in a sense that like I learned a ton. And one of the benefits about these big companies is they are so big. And if you are motivated, you can find many different experiences inside of one. Like I kind of think about it as like going to Disneyland versus like going to a playground, right? The big company is the Disneyland, and there's like a ton of rides you can ride, and there's like so many different things you can do. And so I worked on a few different products. I worked on Parse, which was this like mobile app development platform that I started working at Facebook on, and then worked on video for a while, and then I moved to Instagram. And so like, it didn't feel like 7.5 years. It felt like lots of different jobs in the process. But at some point, I just got kind of bored. It just felt like designing the same thing over and over again, you know, and like it started to feel more like politics than making stuff, and just wasn't super fulfilling anymore. And, you know, I was looking around at what was out there, and, you know, like I get a lot of recruiting emails. It's like, come reinvent the future of payroll. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. Somebody should do that. Like, that seems important, but it doesn't seem like something that would be super interesting to me. And so I kind of thought I was just done. I kind of thought that I was just, maybe that's it. Maybe I've like burnt myself out on design and I should just give up. And so, you know, I was interviewing with like another big company that I was really interested in that seemed like, oh, it's got to be better at this company. And so I got pretty deep in the process there, and I was almost about to go there, and then Humane sort of popped up, and, you know, I had some chats, and I really just liked the vibes. I liked the people. I had no idea what the product was. I didn't know anything other than these people all seem really good and really smart, and it's a smaller company. And I think that was the main thing for me was, again, Facebook being my only job, right? Like, I took it because it got me out of Florida. I don't know that I took it because I like really thought, like I really thought super deeply about what I was going to get from that. I was just like, wow, an opportunity to go from this like agency that I work at to Facebook. Of course I'm going to take that. And then you kind of get carried away in the momentum of like working at a company like that. And I don't think I ever really stopped to think about what do I actually like to do and what is the right environment for me. And Humane felt like a way to change as many variables in that equation at once. Smaller company, working on hardware, didn't know anyone, didn't know what the product was. I had zero idea of anything. And so at the very least, I'll go, I'll work there 6 months. And if I hate it, I can just leave, because it's not like I'm not going to be like tied to this job forever. And I'll probably learn a lot in the process. And now, you know, 2.5 years later, still there, still learning and still having a really good time.
Can you give people a little bit more context around what your role at Humane is? And Also, what the heck it was like ramping up in those first few months where you're kind of like, hey, by the way, this is the product that we're working on.
My title is product designer. I don't think I've done much traditional product designy things in probably a little bit over a year, but it was pretty wild. I made the mistake, and for anyone listening to this, don't make the same mistake as me. I left Facebook on a Friday and started Humane on a Monday.
Like, oh my God.
I didn't take any time off because, and I had kind of a good reason, I had just taken a bunch of time off. I felt like I don't need to take any more time off. I just took a bunch of time off. Like, I'm good. And I don't think I really grasped how much of a shift it was going to be. Painful in the way that going to the gym first time in a while is painful, that it's, this hurts a lot, but I know it's good for me. And I know that, like, this is what I should be doing. But it was pretty jarring going from like a big company to a very small startup. I feel like at startups, it's kind of different every 3 months. Like, it's constant change, which is good and exciting if you like change and you like to, like, have different experiences. And so the experience I was having those first few months, 2.5 years ago, is completely different than, like, the world that I exist in now. You know, the team has spent quite a long time figuring out the hardware, because that is very hard. Making hardware is incredibly complicated and challenging, and you can't push a software update to fix something physical about a piece of hardware. And so there's a lot of pressure to get it as close to right as possible on the first try. And so from the software side of things, there were lots of ideas. Like, I remember Ken Kashenda, who interviewed me, and when I first started, we had a chat, and he described it as, there are, like, multiple islands of ideas, and there's not really anything connecting them all together yet. And I think for the first, probably the whole year, it was really just like, we were just vibing. Like, honestly, like, we were just sort of exploring, because we didn't really have devices that we could live with yet. Like, that was still in process. There were so many moving targets. What's the display going to look like? What kind of AI are we going to have? How good are a lot of these things going to be? And those were questions we didn't have answers to until, like, a year and a half later. And so there was a lot of just speculation. There was a lot of, maybe it could be like this. Maybe it could be like that. What if we, like, string all these things together this way? And I feel like, honestly, we probably designed and threw away the entire system at least 5 to 6 times. But in that process, we learned about what felt good and what didn't feel good. And every time we blew it up and started over and put the pieces back together in a different way, we did it with the learnings of the experiments before. And so every time it got a little better. And every time I think we were able to simplify it a little more, and we were able to just sort of understand what this thing might be. But anytime you're making something totally new that has not existed before, there is some amount of intuition and just educated guess. And we wanted it to exist. You know, that was kind of the bar in our design conversations, was you would put something up on the screen and the reaction you wanted from the room was, we all want that. We want that. We want a thing that does that.
I want to go deeper into that exploration process, because Humane's such a unique product in that,
yes,
the quality of the user experience is kind of directly tied to the quality of the AI output. So what is it like being a designer who's exploring all these ideas when, you know, you're not just drawing rectangles in Figma, really, ever?
Totally. I mean, that was what sort of led me to prototyping in Python over, like, Origami or Figma or something, because I had that realization that the visual aspect of the product is really important, and it's important to get it right, but it's equally important that the thing does what it should do based on what you say. The reason why I moved to Python was because it's just a terminal. It's kind of the best prototyping environment for this conversational design world that we're moving towards, where, like, I didn't have any control over what it looked like. Like, because it wasn't important. And so it helped me focus on, forget all the other stuff, because you're not seeing any of that when you're using voice anyway. You know, like, you're getting the same amount of feedback that you would get from a Python prototype. And so that realization I realized that like this is probably an area I should really go deep on and understand because I didn't understand it. Like I had zero AI experience before Humane. Like I joined, it was the beginning of 2022. So like almost a full year pre-ChatGPT. And it wasn't so early that like no one knew what I was talking about, but it was pretty early that the time these were really framed as, oh, look, the computer can write funny stories for you, you know, not, oh, there is this reasoning and capability that allows us to do different things. And, you know, I just became enamored with playing with these models and just like, it was just so much fun. And how do I experiment with this stuff? Playing with it on, you know, OpenAI has a little playground on their website where you can, you know, interact with the model directly. That's fun. And that got me probably a month or two of fun out of that before I hit a ceiling. And I was like, okay, I need more. Like I need to do more. I want to do more. And so I leveled up to prototyping in Python because that allows you to really, you know, script and have, you know, more of a framework around these models. But it always felt like design. Like, I don't know, like it always still felt like I was doing design things because I really think that design is how it works. How it looks is important, but how it works is also important. And both of those things need equal amounts, if not, you know, more depending upon the context of design attention. And so it never really felt like I wasn't designing, even though I wasn't in Figma. I was just, you know, poking around in Python and playing around. And some of those Python prototypes are like the coolest prototypes I've ever made. Cooler than any origami prototype I've ever made. The fact that I can type a thing into this box and it does the thing that I want it to do just still blows my mind. And it made me feel good that knowing that I was more than just rectangles and springs. Because at the end of the day, I just like to make stuff. And I think that that is what I realized coming to Humane was remembering that part of myself, of that I just like to make things. And it doesn't really matter what tool or what I have to do to make, I just want to make something cool. And so it was nice to make some Python things that were mind blowing to me, at least.
A big part of prototyping is using those prototypes to get buy-in from the team and get people excited about what you're doing. So what does that look like then in an AI world?
What I used to love to do at Instagram was I would make origami prototypes and I would put them on my phone and I would just like roll up to somebody's desk and just like shove my phone in their hand and not give them any context, just like get to like read their reaction from start to finish and just like see what do they tap on, what do they try to do, what do they not try to do. With a Python prototype, it's still doable, but it's a lot more awkward to like roll up to somebody's desk with your whole laptop and throw a terminal in front of them and be like, hey, type something in. And they're like, what? Like, what are you talking about? And so at a certain point, I realized like, okay, I need a way to get these to more people. I just need more people to try this stuff to really understand. One of the ways that I did that was through Slack, because I realized everybody has Slack at the company. Like the distribution platform is kind of figured out. Slack's kind of like Python in the sense that it has a text input and you can type some stuff in and hit enter and get a response. And I was like, I wonder if I can use Slack as like a distribution method for these prototypes. And so I figured out using Vercel, which allows you to host Python scripts as like APIs, that plus like, you know, all, through all of this using AI to code, because I didn't know Python. I've never made a Slack bot before. I've never done Node before. Like I've never done any of these things before. Figured out how to make a Slack bot of my prototype. And so I was able to just like migrate this Python prototype into Slack and release it on the company and get a lot of people using it, which I learned a lot through that process. Like I had a coworker ask the prototype a question in Chinese and it answered in Chinese. And it was a really mind-blowing moment for me, you know, this losing these hard edges of your prototype and that you're really just sort of defining this experience and the models extrapolate out from there. And so like I never anywhere in the prototype was here is how Chinese works. Like here are what these different languages are. It just sort of, you know, I described it well enough in English and it was able to extrapolate that out to like all these other use cases that I hadn't considered. And that was pretty nuts. It was pretty wild.
The concept of losing the hard edges of a prototype is fascinating to me. I've never considered that before. It makes a lot of sense. I would still imagine that you know, you have learning goals when you're putting this prototype out in front of someone. So can you talk a little bit about what success looks like in a world where it's way less clear because there's not this predefined flow? And maybe you could even share like a specific aha moment or something that you learned in this prototyping process that informed what the product ultimately became.
With a lot of this stuff, and with AI in particular, I kind of look at it as this like alien space metal that has crash landed on the planet. And it's a new material. It's like a new thing that as designers, we get to work with. And the only way you really understand a material super well is by just experimenting with it and like trying stuff and just like continuing to push the envelope of, well, what can this thing do? You know, like, imagine if you had the first time you saw wood, you're like, what do I do with wood? You know, and you would start trying things and you'd be like, oh, if I bend it this way, it breaks. But if I like heat it up with steam and bend it around this other thing, I can make these like really cool curved edges that you just have to go deep on these materials and just try a lot of stuff to see where they break and to see where they don't break. And so for me, it was really just about continuing to just escalate and see how far I could go and, you know, releasing these prototypes to a broader audience. And going back to the thing about, you know, the losing the hard edges is I didn't know where it would break. Like I can play with it myself. I can give it to a few people and have them play with it. And we find a certain subset of things that just based off what we all think to ask, but the broadness of human curiosity is so vast that, you know, it was really just more of like a brute force exercise of, I just needed a lot of people to try this thing and to try to break it. And it would break. It would, you know, give stupid answers or do something wrong or get stuck. It's a little bit more what I assume like teaching a child is like, you know, where you think you've given it everything it needs to not fall over the first time riding a bike. And then, you know, it starts riding the bike and it falls over and you're like, and you see what it did wrong and you're like, oh, don't do this next time. And through this, I think what you're actually doing with AI is you're just more clearly defining what you want to happen and your prompts get crisper and more concise. And, you know, through all of this, you're learning the material better and better. And every time it would break, and I would understand why it broke and I'd be like, oh, I see. And I would tweak the prompt or like move something around or do whatever. And eventually it just stops breaking. Eventually it just like does what it's supposed to do more often than not. And I think through that and through all of that experimentation, you gain this like deep understanding for the material that then you can translate to other projects. You know, then when we're like talking about how the actual server architecture should work. You know, it's like, it's a different language, it's a different context, but the material is still the same. And so that understanding of the material transfers to bigger things where, you know, I might not know everything that's going on, but I do understand the material really well. And I can use that to help make it better in other contexts.
This is getting really in the weeds, but I wanted to ask about the response to something breaking in a prototype. Like you talked about tweaking the prompt. I'm curious to learn more about that because in my mind, that starts to sit squarely in more of like a traditional engineering role. Like you solve the problem with code. And so I'm curious, like when you identified an opportunity or a shortcoming, what was design's role in actually creating a patch or an improvement, and how much of that were you able to own with your limited Python background?
Yeah, well, I mean, at this point, it was truly just a prototype. It was solely owned by me, by design. There was really no official like engineering resources helping me with this thing. The term like prompt engineering gets thrown around a lot. I think that that's an interesting term. I kind of think prompt design is more of an interesting term to me in that it's such an interesting combination of skills necessary to play with these models in an interesting way. And I think that it ends up being a hybrid of engineering, obviously, like they're having some understanding of code and how that side of things works very important. Less important today because a lot of times you can just ask the model how things work and like it'll explain it to you, but having some baseline there is important. Then I think that there's a writing aspect to it. There is really like, you know, traditionally engineers are not, the quality of the software doesn't have anything to do with how they named their variables, right, in their code, right? Like that stuff just never mattered before. And now suddenly the words that you choose in these prompts have a big impact in how the thing actually works, which I think makes it tough for more traditional engineers to get into this space because they're just not used to thinking that way. And it's kind of almost more of a design skill than an engineering skill because it really boils down to like communication, which I think is something that most designers have a stronger grasp at because you need it to get your job done. You need to be able to communicate your ideas clearly and effectively to stakeholders. And so like, if you think of the model as a stakeholder, you know, designers are really set up well to like communicate effectively with them. And then there's like a real design aspect to it of, you know, a lot of times I think about it like I'm designing this kitchen and the model is the chef, and I have to put the right things in the kitchen in the right place so that the model can make whatever the customer orders, because we don't know what they're going to order. And so it's just like, you know, and that's where a lot of the like the trial and error of, oh crap, somebody came in and ordered this thing and we didn't have a lemon peeler. And so I need to like add a lemon. And this is a very abstract example, but like that three-way like writer, engineer, design combo makes it, I think, just it made it really fun for me. And so a lot of times the iteration was just seeing where it fell off the rails and being like, oh, we need to add this kind of tool, or like, oh, we should add, you know, this pre-processing step in the pipeline so that we have this piece of information here so that we can, when we, if we need it, we have it. And so just stuff like that of like, you know, thinking through why it fell off the rails. And if it, that all of that's design, really, you know, it's like, it's experience design. It's no different than thinking through like, why did this person fall off this like onboarding flow? You know, it's like, it's kind of all the same. To me, it feels like very similar skills.
You mentioned all of the comfort and familiarity that had accrued over the years at Meta and how this was really just like a changing of all of the variables. Listening to you talk, one way that it's clear that you've grown is through adopting more of like a technical skill set and being able to prototype in Python. That's amazing. I'm curious, now that you know all these variables have changed, you're a little over 2 years in, are there other ways that you've been pulled out of your comfort zone or stretched and grown as a designer while at Humane?
This has been a real sort of like Olympic level comfortable with ambiguity challenge, you know, which I think is like, I think that that is a very critical skill for a designer to have. I think that a lot of people really struggle with that and they need someone like a PM or whoever to really chop the thing up and make it here, do these exact things. And, you know, you don't have to use your brain very much. And when you're in a space like this, you have no choice but to get so comfortable with not knowing what's going on and not knowing what the right move is because none of this stuff has been done before. I feel like these bigger companies really, they struggle with the uncertainty and everything needs to be, well, the metric went up. And, you know, it's like, it's just a lot of like, how can we be sure that we're doing the right thing? And I think that boxes off a lot of paths when you have to be confident that you're making the product better somehow through numbers, because not everything can be measured that way. And especially with brand new ideas, it's like, it takes time to figure this stuff out. You know, it takes a lot of trial and error. And I think it takes more time and trial and error than a lot of these bigger companies have patience for. You know, everybody wants, what's the next hit? What's the thing that's going to like get us a bajillion new users tomorrow? And it's like, good stuff takes time.
I want to zoom out from Humane and look at kind of the broader landscape. And I actually want to start with a bit of an out there hypothetical. I want you to imagine that we're recording this on a Friday, so you're due another Friday to Monday. And on Monday morning, you start a new role at more of a traditional SaaS company. Maybe that boring payroll company that you were talking about.
Why are you doing this to me?
What are some of the ways that you would be experimenting with the alien space metal to figure out what it unlocks for more of a traditional business?
all of the best stuff I ever did at Facebook, Instagram, Humane, whatever, was not anything anyone told me to do. It was just stuff that I thought should exist. And I just did it. And I just made it. And nobody told me to do it. It wasn't like on the roadmap. It wasn't like, you know, a real project. And I just made it because I felt like it needed to exist. And luckily, a lot of the times they were good enough ideas that it got other people excited about it too. And like, we figured out ways to make it happen. And so I think that's probably what I would do, is like, whatever nonsense I'm supposed to be doing in this new SaaS job that I have, I would do that stuff probably, or I would find ways to like get out of it and say no, to make time to just make what I want to make and make what I think should be part of this thing. And then just make demos and just show them to people and be here. What if we had this? I think that you just have to get more comfortable following your curiosity and not really caring so much about, oh, is this gonna solve this goal? Is this gonna like make my PM happy? Is this gonna like whatever? It's just, you just have to make what feels right to you. And I think that the rest of it will kind of fall into place.
Okay, so let's zoom all the way out now. One of the things that you said earlier to me is that AI really changes the meaning of software. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
If you think about why we make software in the first place, right? It's because traditionally computers have been very hard to interact with. You know, if you go all the way back to like the beginnings of computers, you were literally plugging cables and turning knobs, and you needed to be an actual computer scientist to like understand how these things work. And then, you know, slowly over time, we've built up, first of all, a lot of, you know, underlying foundations that we all just take for granted these days. The fact that you don't have to think about assembly language when you're like writing software, because there's like all these layers in between that take very nice to read programming languages and convert them into CPU speak. But at the end of the day, found like programming today, code software today is still not, you couldn't give someone a GitHub repo. Like you couldn't give a regular person a GitHub repo and say, here's your software. You need that UI layer in front of it to help someone understand the capabilities of the code that's underneath it, right? So to present all of the different actions and possibilities to the user, but also to like make sure that they press the buttons in the right order, because that's how the program works. And if you try to press button C before you press button A, the program wasn't built for that. And so it just breaks. And so when you think about a world where you have this technology in a large language model that both understands English and Java or Python or whatever, that you have this universal translator that you just ask for what you want, or you describe the thing you're trying to do, and it can go in the code and find that the relevant code and just make it happen. Then the need for all of these buttons and all of this interface kind of gets a little bit softer. You know, why do I need to do all of these individual discrete steps when I could just say what I want and get it? And when you're in a world where like you can just say what you want and get it, you probably don't need software quite as much, you know, like, and I don't think it's ever going to completely evaporate, but I think it's going to change why software exists, what software still exists in the future, how software manifests itself to people. Like, there's just so much that we can do differently now that we couldn't do before.
I'm picturing this spectrum where on one end of the spectrum, it's, you know, that basically that traditional SaaS company with a chatbot to interact with AI. And on the other end of the spectrum, there's no interface. And it's just talk to AI and do all of the things that you want. I think realistically, we're going to find some kind of a middle ground. I'm curious, do you have any thoughts on what that middle ground might look like, where AI is more deeply embedded, but it might not be realistic to just have voice as the singular modality and you're not even looking at a screen?
I think the problem is that we're still missing some pieces of the puzzle. You know, like this is all still very new and there's clearly a lot of opportunity here. There's still some pieces missing. Like one great example of this is like the Claude artifacts stuff that came out recently. I don't know if you had a chance to play with that, but like it's not necessarily anything new. Like it's not any new breakthrough. It was just somebody at Anthropic was like, you know, I wonder what would happen if we let Claude write into an iframe and just like put the iframe in the window. The model could do that the whole time. Like there wasn't anything really groundbreaking there. It was just that like someone put the pieces together in the right order and suddenly something like this makes sense. I mean, like ChatGPT is another incredible example of this. There's literally the only thing new about ChatGPT was that they put messages in chat bubbles, right? Like you're still interacting with the exact same model that existed before. You look at it from the right angle or you put the right couple pieces on top of it and suddenly it's like this whole new thing that suddenly makes sense. And so where I kind of see software going is to back to your spectrums, right? Like on one end of the spectrum, you're going to have traditional software that you still use. Like I think there will always be a Photoshop, really useful tools that people use to do their jobs, right? That's still going to exist. You may end up in a world where you open Photoshop and it's in auto mode, where there is just like a command bar input. And you could just talk to Photoshop and get your task done. Or if you're feeling like it, you can switch it into manual mode the same way you would like do in a car and have more control over the tool. And then all the buttons come in and like, you know, you have your more traditional interface. But again, you have a choice there. If you're just doing something very simple, like, hey, cut this person out of this photo and blah, 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 blah. You know, it might be just faster to open the image and say that and then walk away and get coffee and come back and it's just done. And that could be nice. And then on the other end of the spectrum, it's so easy with AI because it's so convincing and so compelling to just like let it do the whole task and let it do it from one shot. Make me a blah, blah, blah app. And everybody wants the demo where it's like, you know, the Rube Goldberg machine goes and the app pops out the other end and it's perfect, right? That's not, just because it can do that, it doesn't mean that it's the right way to do that. That's going to get you actually good output. A lot of what I've found is that it's easy to jump to that because that sounds amazing. That sounds like so great to have this one-stop thing where I say one thing and it does exactly what I want the whole way through. I think in reality, what you want is to design a process that keeps the person in the loop, right? You go off and say, hey, make me this app, right? Instead of the app popping out the other end, you get, I don't know, maybe like three different outlines of what the app could do. Hey, which of these sound like what you're talking about? And so thinking of it more as this iterative back and forth process rather than this magic app machine that just does everything perfectly, I think that's one of the bigger pieces that's missing today is that like people are focusing too much on the flashy demo and the thing that's going to get a lot of likes on Twitter. And the other thing is it's much more complicated to think through that and make that system. And I think there are a lot of people right now who are just, you know, as with any new space, people are trying to cash grab and trying to get a lot of attention. You know, we saw this with crypto and we saw this with the internet in the first place. Like it's just, anytime there's a new thing like this, you're going to have no shortage of people who come out and try to be experts and try to just like capitalize on the current situation because it's easy. But I think that over time, we will see more of these pieces start to come into focus and pieces that like we don't even realize we need yet. It will kind of happen naturally on its own. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think if you have a computer that you can talk to that understands you, why would you want to do everything manually? It just sounds so much more freeing to just be able to give your computer a list of tasks to do each day. The same way if you had your own actual assistant or an intern or something, you know, it's just like, hey, go off and explore some of these things today and let me know what you figure out.
The more that you think about this kind of stuff, the more that you envision potential futures at Humane, but also for the broader industry, what are some of the ways that your thinking has evolved in terms of how you picture your long-term role as a designer?
We have gotten so enamored as an industry with the app, right? It's sort of like the perfect medium for expressing ideas. And it's like, it's so easy because these platforms make it so easy. And so the entire world has really revolved around the app for like the past 10 years. And it's easy to think that like that's the only thing that exists. That's the only possibility is like make an app. There are so many constraints that you adopt, whether you realize it or not, when you choose to make an app that dictate a lot of what you do and a lot of what you can do. And so for me, I think it was really just great to remember that there are other possibilities out there. There are other things you can do. Like I can contribute as a designer writing code. I can contribute as a designer 3D printing stuff. If you think that the only way you can provide value is by shuffling rectangles around in Figma, then you should try to do some other stuff, because I feel like the value in a designer is really creative problem solving. Set a marker all the way off in the distance, and it's like, how do we get there? That path from A to B, and not relying on, well, we'll just call a Waymo and get there. You know, like, it's like, how do you get there? What do you need to build to get there? What's the right route? There are so many, what's standing, you start down that path and then there's like a canyon and you're like, oh crap, how do we get across this thing? That ability to look at situations and understand what needs to happen, or what you should try, what you should explore to get over and to where you want to go. That, I think, is the real value in a product designer. The rectangles are just, they just happen to be the current most useful way for a lot of people to express that value. But there's so many other ways, I think, to provide that value.
Hey guys, real quick, if you know me, then you know I love products. So I want to take just 30 seconds to tell you about three of my favorites. Now, anytime that I'm designing and building a website, you better believe that I'm going to use Framer. I made the switch recently and I'm never going back. Now, once it's time to animate my designs and showcase my work, that's when I'm going to use Jitter. It's like Figma, only for motion design. And every step of the way, I'm going to be using Raycast constantly. It's the cornerstone of how I use my computer and the way that I stay in flow while I work. Now, I hand-selected Framer, Raycast, and Jitter to partner with me so that I could do these interviews full-time. So if you want to show them some love, it would mean a lot. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode. I want to talk to a specific archetype of a listener right now. Someone who maybe is like 5 years into their career, they're in their second or third role, they feel like they really have their sea legs under them, and then it kind of feels like you look into the future and everything's about to change. What are some of the ways that you can future-proof your career by investing in that skill of creative problem solving? I think it's something that we talk a lot about, but it's also like a little bit woo-woo, because it's like, okay, well, what does that actually mean? Like, how do I advance towards that end goal?
I think that change is constant, not just in our industry, but in the world. Like in life, change is a constant thing. And you can choose to hide from the change and pretend like it doesn't exist, even though it does exist and it will catch up to you eventually. Or you can choose to lead into the change and just be like, yeah, rectangles are out now. What's the next new thing that's going to come in? And I got into all of this because it just looked fun. It just looked like a fun, cool thing to do. You know, like I was on Twitter in like the early 2010s looking at these people making these like incredible iPhone applications and being like, that looks really fun. I don't know what's involved in that. I don't know how any of that works, but gosh, it just seems really cool to do that kind of stuff. And now I'm seeing like all this AI stuff and I'm like, I don't know how any of this stuff works, but it looks cool and it looks fun. And like, I want to do that. And I think that what it boils down to is just getting really good at listening to that inner curiosity and that inner feeling of there's something there. The hard part is that a lot of times you can't explain it. You can't verbalize why. You can't quantify it. You can't have a business plan around like what it is. And I think for a lot of people, that's scary. What you can do is just build the habit of following your curiosity, even if it's 20 minutes a day. If you spend 20 minutes a day just doing something purely because it's fun and purely because it sounds interesting. And that could be anything. That could be just like going on Instagram and finding like some crazy shader artist who does wild WebGL stuff and just like try to copy it. Try to see if you can reverse engineer how it happened and make it. I can't promise you that you're going to like do that and see the path and be like, oh, it all makes sense now. You might be poking around in the dark for quite a while, but eventually something will click or you'll look down and you'll realize I've picked up all of these cool things in the process and like I can make something with this. I can put all these things together and like do something now. But it's only obvious in retrospect. I think the going forward is really you just gotta try stuff and explore and not have a plan.
Can we talk a little bit about your journey interacting with AI as a way to learn Python then? Kind of just to paint the picture of what this kind of experimentation process can look like. What did you learn about how to leverage AI on your own learning journey?
One of the exciting things about these models is that it takes text, any kind of text, and it's immediately interactive, right? Which is kind of hard to like wrap your head around a little bit. The fact that I can just take any chunk of text and paste it into one of these models and then be able to do stuff to it, summarize it, pull out some action item, rewrite this as a poem, that silly transformational stuff. But also, hey, can you explain what this thing means? Or can you go deeper? I don't really understand what's happening here. Can you explain this for me? Or another one thing I did the other day was like taking like a WebGL shader and just like throwing it in and being like, can you just add a bunch of comments to this? Can you just like comment the shader for me so I can like read it and understand it? Like that ability to make text interactive, I think is so powerful. And it still just blows my mind every time it happens that it like works at all, right? And I think that really levels the playing field for learning new things, you know, because you can start at any stage, right? I do have somewhat of a coding background. You know, I don't have a computer science degree. I didn't go to school for any of this stuff, but I grew up on the internet. I make websites, like, you know, I know JavaScript. I understand some of the foundational pieces that are important, that like fundamental vocabulary of variables and functions. And that stuff doesn't change from language to language. Like the core concepts, I think you can kind of think, I know they're called programming languages. I kind of think of them as like programming dialects because it's really all English. Like it's all actually English. It's just that, oh, the way Java does this is a little different than the way Python does that. And you have to learn the local slang for these things. But knowing the fundamentals, I could just ask, hey, GPT-4, I want to do this string manipulation thing in Python. How do I do that? You know, and the fact that I know to ask for that specific thing comes from me having this experience. But it's just as easy for someone to be like, hey, when I put this in, I want this to come out. How do I do that in Python? Not knowing any of the language or terminology or how you would ask for that, it doesn't care. It's just as happy to answer my specific technical question as it is to answer that like very simple, basic, you know, beginner style question. And both of them are going to get good answers, you know? And so I think that anything you want to do now, you have this like on-demand tutor that is infinitely patient, that will never get frustrated or bored or like charge you more money for more sessions or whatever. And it knows a lot about everything. You know, these models aren't perfect, but like they know a lot. They know so much stuff is sort of baked inside of them. And it really just boils down to your persistence. And, you know, sometimes it takes some trial and error. They're not perfect. They may give you a silly answer or like misunderstand you or whatever. I think there are two types of people. There are the one type that they play with these models and it does something stupid. And they're like, ha, see, I told you it's stupid. This is a waste of time. It doesn't make any sense. And then I think there are the other type of person who sees them and are like, oh my God, I can't believe this works at all. And like, yeah, it's not perfect. But if you ask it in this way, again, going back to the materials, it's like you understand the material more deeply and you know that, oh, if I ask it this way, I get this kind of answer. But if I add this piece of context, I'll get a different, better kind of answer or whatever. The person who's curious and keeps digging is the one who's going to learn that. The person who just like dismisses it immediately because it messed up once, they're never going to get that understanding or that knowledge. So it really comes down to just how bad do you want to learn the thing you want to learn, you know? And for me, it's just like, well, I want to make this prototype. I'm not going to stop until I get somewhere that I'm happy with. And so I just would just spend hours just trying to make it work. If you're persistent, you can get a lot of interesting places.
I love that answer because I do agree with the two buckets of people. And I was even taking notes as you talked, and that was something that I was writing down, which is like, there's a line drawn in the sand between who is inherently a skeptic versus people who are like, wow, can you imagine what this might be able to do a year from now or 2 years from now? And you can just exist in awe of the current capabilities so easily. And another thing that you said that I kind of just want to even draw an underline on that I thought was a really practical tidbit was this idea of giving a model some chunk of code and asking it to comment the code as a way to understand it. Because something that has been mentioned a couple times on this show is the importance of understanding the shape of code. Like, you don't have to really understand a lot of the syntax, but man, if you can understand generally what code looks like, AI can take that little kernel of knowledge and really give you superpowers. So I thought that was a pretty interesting tactic. So I just wanted to underline it for people.
The playing field leveling ability for these models, I think, is pretty wild and pretty exciting. I hesitate to say scary because I don't think it's actually scary, but if you're afraid of change, it's scary, right? And I think that it's true for code, but it's also true for being good at Googling stuff, which is like a skill. Like, using a search engine is a skill. You know, now you'll have this model, you know, English is not your first language. That's not going to be a barrier anymore because you can use these things to speak perfect English. You know, you don't know what you're looking for exactly. You can use a model to sort of like narrow your search query down and understand what you don't understand better. So it really is such a good time for a designer who wants to learn stuff because I think the ceiling has just been lifted. So many things that were so unapproachable because you'd have to like piece together 15 different Stack Overflow articles and like try to understand the docs that are written for like other engineers. And there's all these words. And you're like, I just want to make this thing. Now you can just describe the thing and the model will help you figure out how to get there. There was a point early when I was in college where I was like, should I do computer science or should I do design? And I was very torn at the time. And what it boiled down to for me was that, and I'm generalizing a lot here, but when I looked at programming, you get an error message when your program doesn't work. You get like, you know, you try to run it and you get an error and you can Google that error and find the answer, you know? And so to me, programming always felt more about resourcefulness than really like knowing computer science very much. Whereas design, I couldn't Google, why don't people post to Instagram more and find like a chunk of code that I can copy and paste and like put into Figma to fix my design. There's that level of intuition there that you only get through time. All of that being said, I think code is a material the same way that these models are a material. And I would really encourage anyone who's interested in being a good software designer to have some foundational, you don't need to go that deep anymore because the model can help you go deep when you need it. But having that foundational understanding of how programs work and how code works, I think is just going to make you a better designer because you understand the material that you're working with better. And so I would still encourage people to do that. But I do think that the ceiling and the learning curve has flattened a bit. There isn't that steep barrier to entry so much as there used to be, but it's still a useful thing to understand, I think.
Well, George, this has been amazing. I hope people listening are as inspired as I am. Thank you for just coming on, taking the time to share a little bit about what you're thinking, some of the journey of the last couple of years. It's been really great to get to know you and hear a little bit more about your journey so far.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's fun to talk about this stuff, and it's always fun to go deep on design stuff. So thanks for the opportunity.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, if you wanna go even deeper, each week I send an email out to over 10,000 designers with bonus resources and key takeaways from these conversations. So head to dive.club/email to sign up. Okay, I'll see you next week.